You're listening to Writer's Block with guest host Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Are you not entertained? Baseball is such a different sport than the others when it's close and tight and it's important. And there's stressful moments in football, sure. There's stressful moments in hockey. Playoff overtime is insane. But there's no sport where you don't exult in victory. You just feel relief, especially when you walk 11. It's, I think, one of four times, maybe one of five times in the history of this franchise, the Toronto Blue Jays have issued 11 or more walks and won a baseball game. They escaped, and that's how it felt yesterday.
Yeah, can we just, we won't go down the road too much, but we should tip our cap to Country Joe West, though, of course, Country Joe, or Cowboy Joe, or whatever he is, just for being remarkably incompetent for all these years. And he's consistent. Like, he's still really terrible. He's 100 years old.
Yep.
It wasn't, quite as egregious as the night before, but it was bad, right? He had a really bad night behind the plate. So let's just... That's not what happened. That's not why they walked all those guys. But let's just tip our cap to them, because we did tee it up yesterday.
We should. And I don't know if it's just that we're on high alert because of the Ron Culpa game from 2 days ago, but it just feels like consecutive days of, wow, we're really not at the apex of umpiring here. Yes. In Major League Baseball.
Not the gold standard. This was not whoever that would be. I'm not sure who is the greatest. No, it's funny. No one ever talks about the greatest umpire of all time.
Yeah.
West probably does, because he's got an opinion about who the greatest umpire of all time is, but he's awful. Jesus. So let's get past that. So he's awful. The line, I was thinking last night, the finest of lines was Joey Wendell that ripped the ball. He's the last out, but he rips the ball foul by a foot.
Foot and a half. Yeah.
And that, and all, you know, with it being the Rays and the Trop and everything, all three of those runs would have scored. They would have won on that
100%.
Hit. Right.
Yep.
Cause that's what they do. And Romano walks the bases loaded. Then that happens, and everybody today is very different. But instead, he misses a pitch by an inch, makes a routine fly ball out. Romano's happy. Everybody's happy. It's all about Alek Manoah's grittiness, which is which is worth discussing. The guy is tenacious. I like a lot of things about him. He wasn't at his best last night, but and we won't talk about a guy like Tim Mazza, who just came out there and was routinely great. Like, he's been great all the time. Is Mr. Reliable. Yeah. An odd, tense, nail-biting game, especially knowing that, the Yankees were winning and the Red Sox were winning and winning easily. So, yeah, welcome to the pennant race. And, they have now hit the kind of, in this series, the minimum acceptable result was getting 1 of 3, right?
That's right.
2 out of 3 is awesome.
Yep.
Sweep almost unimaginable in the drop. But if you, now we're past, that bar has been cleared.
Right, yes. That's absolutely correct. I mean, it's the Rays have not played their best baseball in this month at all. I think they're below 500. I think they're 9-10 mm-hmm. headed into today's game in the month. They haven't looked their best, and I think part of that was just natural regression, because we ended yesterday's show. You asked me if they looked like a World Series team, and I wanted to kind of temper my response there, because they are in a position that puts them first in the American League.
Yes, they are.
And they were just in a World Series not that long ago. But I think the idea that they were going to score 6 runs a game probably was not going to be the case throughout the entirety of the second half of the season, which it had been basically up until this point. I still think they're the highest scoring team in baseball since the All-Star break. So there is some natural regression coming. But yeah, the pitching's good. They're a good team. And I'm not speaking out of school. Like, they're a good team, obviously, and they have the best record in the American League. But there is some regression coming for them. Yeah, the Manoah thing is, we've seen that at times this season. He's been outstanding. His last start against the Rays was that. It was 8 innings, 1 hit, 10 strikeouts. Like, we've seen that. But his ability to just gut out outings like that, and there was a Joe Westing of some of those walks, no doubt.
Or at least and at bats, right? It doesn't even have to be the walk, but it's just the way, we talked about this a bit yesterday, the way 2-0 is different than 1-1, right? Like the way a count, one bad call in an at-bat can change the at-bat really dramatically, and that happened a bunch of times.
It did, and they needed him. I mean, there was a point where Salcedo was warming the bullpen. I want to say that was like the second inning.
It was.
And you thought, oh, boy, not only is this bad, obviously, losing your starter in the second inning, but you got a bullpen game coming up in the finale in an afternoon game. The idea that you're going to need seven innings out of your bullpen a day before, well, now it's Julian Merriweather and then Ross Stripling, who has not looked at his best since coming off the IL. But instead, Manoah gets out of a bases-loaded jam, and it was kind of interesting. They fixed the mound, and all of a sudden, he looked like a different dude. He struck out the side. It was almost an immaculate inning.
It was, yep, that was interesting. A little bit of clay pounded in the mound, and I don't know if it was the break or the change in the topography or what it was, but something worked for him. Yeah, he did. He came out and looked I just steadier, you know, just for whatever reason. But yeah, no, those extra two or three innings they got out of him, never mind the fact they were effective innings, you know, in terms of today. Now, today's going to be a bit of a dog's breakfast, so we'll see. Mm-hmm. Like, the other weird thing last night, among the weird things, was that Michael Wacha showing up and suddenly throwing 97, by the way.
Yeah, which is, and Michael Wacha has been around for a while. He's not in the Cy Young discussion, right? Like, he's an ERA in the mid fours.
He was supposed to start today.
Yeah, he was supposed to start today, but he's got an ERA in the mid fours and has not been a super effective starter. But all of a sudden, you do the Rays thing and you shorten him up. And this has happened with starter upon starter who's gone to the bullpen. Even Ryan Baraki, while he hasn't been able to hit the zone, like, you put him in a relief role, he's throwing 97, 98.
Jordan Romano, right? Jordan Romano as a starter never did that, right? And it didn't throw 100. Now he throws 100.
Yeah. No, I was very, very curious. And you wonder if the start from Boz and getting what they did out of him earlier in the first game of the series impacts Michael Wacha, who might not have, I mean, that's like a fifth starter type role that he was mm-hmm. playing for this team earlier on. And we know how valuable or not valuable those guys are come the postseason. They don't end up usually on your roster, but the guy yesterday would have.
Yeah, well, they've got some injuries in the bullpen. Nick Anderson doesn't look like
not
himself.
Not at all.
Right?
Like, so, Nick Anderson was the best reliever in baseball not that long ago. And that, you know what, that happens sometimes when you get overused like he did in the postseason.
Yeah. So, of course, being the Rays, they just throw Michael Wacha out there, and suddenly he's dominant and throwing 95, 96, 97. So, of course, he'll just take that role now. He'll be the two-inning bridge guy in their bullpen for the playoffs, right? That's,
of course,
because of the Rays, and they did that. I didn't actually hear Kevin Cash's explanation afterwards, but I'm sure what that was a, you're right. They saw Boz and said, you know, this guy might be more than serviceable even in the postseason. We've got injuries in the bullpen. We can patch together a bullpen game in this third game of this series anyway. Why don't we just take a look at him?
Yeah.
Why don't we take a look at him and see what he looks like? And because we got that luxury because the division's all wrapped up. And he looked great. You know, they didn't win the game, but he looked really, really good. So, yeah, very, very odd, strange kind of ball game yesterday. Good to see the Blue Jays being opportunistic. You know, some good base running, like some little stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Semien going first to third and Vlad taking second on the throw.
Yeah, Springer running the bases really well.
And
his bat looked a lot more alive last night than it has.
110 mile an hour line drive off a glove at third base.
Yep. So, you know, that's a game they definitely could have lost. But now, you breathe easy. And if you get the third game of this series, you get the game this afternoon, then that puts them 9-10 on the season, right, against the Rays. Is that correct?
Yep.
So that's, you know, 9-10 with a bunch of winnable games on the loss side there. That's, you know, all of that stuff, they can't beat the Rays. Well, they've beat them almost as much as they've lost to them this year.
Yes, with an entirely different team than I would hazard to guess. The majority of those losses came against the Blue Jays team that didn't have this bullpen.
Yeah.
And again, this bullpen's not the best in baseball, but it's miles better than the one in June and July. Now we're talking about the bullpen, though. And those were the high leverage guys that they used in those three innings after Manoah left the game. But I do expect some different usage. If the Blue Jays do get to the postseason and in that wild card game or beyond, I expect some different usage, but maybe I shouldn't. But most teams do this, right? Like Mariano Rivera was a six-out closer at his best. Okay, I'm not comparing Jordan Romano to Mariano Rivera other than he's this team's best reliever and has been basically all season after he figured out how to throw the slider again after they removed the sticky stuff from his fingers. But I assume if they make the postseason, it'll be, if it's a one-run game, you see him in the eighth inning. We talked about this the other day. If, like, if you start using your higher leverage guys in games that you're trailing, but only slightly, and that's a bit of a different discussion. But in a very close ball game where you're leading,
and you're going through the meat of the order in the eighth,
and you're going, and yeah. And I know Mays has been great, and you know what, Trevor Richards has been great too. But I wonder if you that just like if it's good enough to win a postseason game. This is as close as you're going to get when you're talking about the final 2 weeks of the regular season.
Yeah, they haven't. They haven't had to flip flop. They haven't had to do that with Romano because of those other two guys.
Yeah.
And you can add Simber to a degree, right? Because Simber, yep. Especially
against,
you
know, righties.
If there's a string of righties you can bring in, he's lights out against right-handers. So they've got – Charlie's got some options there that – so he doesn't have to deviate, even though, you know, kind of modern baseball thinking would say that's what you should do. You know, take your – when the leverage is highest, use your best guy, whether it's the eighth or the ninth, you know, maybe not the seventh. Mm-hmm. But I guess Meza has been good enough, mm-hmm. especially Meza, that you can kind of be orthodox here and get away with it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and maybe the idea of even, yeah, that strategy changing in the postseason, why would it have to if these guys are as mm-hmm. good as they've been?
Yeah. So the question's going to be, you know, and again, I think this is the question for the next 2 weeks as well. When you have to use somebody other than those four guys. Mm-hmm. I'm very intrigued to see Merriweather, who's the opener today, mm-hmm. and see whether he's starting to look like that guy who was here in April, because mm-hmm. He hasn't. And there's all kinds of reasons why he hasn't pitched all year, and I'm not sure how much of that stretch he was even picking up a baseball. Mm-hmm. But you know, if his arm could come to life a little bit. And you could build a little bit more faith in Nate Pearson's arm coming to life and his control. You know, that's not nothing.
Yeah.
You know, those because like the other guys, the Saucedos, I'm skeptical about Ryan Borucki this season. Yep. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure he's going to get back to where he was, and he's just had enough of injury issues and elbow issues that I wonder about him in general. Who else you got? Soria. You know, it's a crapshoot. Yeah, he's done it before, and I think sometimes Charlie, you can almost see the wheels turning in Charlie's head, thinking, "Well, he's done it before, so I want the experienced guy out there," mm-hmm. even though you know half the time he's been bad. But really, it's those two guys to me that if you could start to believe in Pearson and Merriweather, then you're into a point where you've got a bullpen that could be dominant.
Yeah,
you know, with a starting rotation that has been very, very consistent, getting you 5, 6, 7 innings.
Yeah.
Like that's a pretty potent combination.
Yeah, with this offense and, you know, one of the best hitters in baseball this month hitting seventh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to score runs. Like they'll get shut down occasionally, but
yeah.
That's not the worry, but if you could take what you've got from the rotation again, not knowing what Ryu is going to like, I guess they said the Ryu's going to start that first game of the Yankee series. That's the plan right now.
Yeah.
That's a big moment if that's true for a whole bunch of reasons, but you know the other four guys have been great. You mix that in with two more live arms, like plus arms that there's no arguing with what Merriweather and Pearson can do when they're right. That's not just going to get you into the wild card game necessarily. That could take you a long way.
No, it's true. All right, you want to do. We have to add gate to the end of whatever the picking up of the card out of Alejandro Kirk's pocket, and it's got some good run all over baseball, all over sports. People love stories like that, and it's a great story.
It is a great story.
I should have been tipped off, and I wish somebody had tipped us off yesterday. But we sit in the studio here at Bluer and Jarvis, and we have the big monitors where they show the raw feed as they get ready for the baseball games. And yesterday, whoever is the producer, director of the game, they kept running back that replay of Kiermaier slide at home plate. And I was like, oh, they're going to do something on the game about how close that was and how smart a play that. No.
No, you didn't know it was the Zapruder film, right? I saw it right after we were off the air yesterday. I got a note saying, what do you think from, internally? Because I think we were trying to figure out, Arash is down there.
Arash did a great job digging up some quotes.
He did. Well, he loves, no one loves that better than him. Yeah. He's a good reporter. But there was that, you know, there's a question of, first of all, establishing what it was you were seeing,
yeah,
right? Because it is kind of, you know, when I first looked at it, I said, what actually is that thing, this mysterious thing that he picked up? And then kind of dealing with, you know, how much it matters or doesn't matter, kind of the, you know, the unspoken, is this taking advantage of a situation in a way that's like stealing signs from second base? You're allowed to do it. It's baseball, taking every advantage, or is this some great breach of modern baseball etiquette? Because, of course, you know, Joe DiMaggio didn't have cheat sheets falling out of his pocket,
no,
right?
Not a deal for him.
So, and then there was, you know, who's mad, who's going to plunk Kiermaier when he comes up to bat or not? Is it about him? I'm still not sure what to make of it, to be honest. And then Buck, of course, last night, in his Buck way, just said, this is all crap.
Yep.
Doesn't matter. So it was interesting. It was, you know, Kiermaier's a really smart guy, right? I don't know if you've ever talked to him. He's a really smart guy and a really nice guy. I really like him. But yeah, I think if you were him or I were him, you said, saw this thing on the ground, you pick it up, maybe you walk back to the dugout and give it a read, you know, maybe you hand it to somebody. Like, again, I'm not sure there's any super secret information on there.
I mean, there's probably some things that maybe they thought were true or were confirmed or what. Did the Blue Jays want the Rays to have possession of that? Pretty clearly not. I'll just lay my cards on the table. I had no problem with it at all. I thought it's hard to fault Alejandro Kirk because he didn't do anything. He wasn't like not careful enough with it. It was in his pocket. He made a play and it fell out.
It was contact, right? It was actual physical contact. It wasn't his fault.
But yeah, I do kind of view it as, hey, stealing signs when you got a camera in center field, that's no good, obviously, clearly, and relaying it through the banging of trash cans, that's no good at all. But
no.
Relaying signs as a base runner on second base, and you figured out the sequence, and you touch the side of your helmet when it's a fastball, and you touch the other side when it's a breaking ball, good with that.
Yes.
Entirely good with that.
Age-old baseball stuff.
And baseball is good with that. I mean, they're good with it to the degree that if you're caught doing it, you might take one in the ear hole. But it's an accepted practice in the game. You're right. This isn't an accepted practice because it's a fairly new practice in general, having cheat sheets on you or the pitchers looking into their hat, which I think is so stupid. It's just stupid looking. Or, yeah, the outfielders with their little cheat sheet as well. I had no problem with it. It seems that it wasn't as big a deal as maybe we thought, and the anger wasn't quite as palpable as we thought it might be, and the guy who's hit maybe more base runners per nine innings than anybody in this rotation, you know, the possibility of that happening in that game, maybe a little bit overstated, but yeah, it was interesting.
It was interesting. You know, the other thing is that, maybe it's self-evident, but like Charlie Montoya and Kevin Cash are real close. You know, number one, they work together. But the other, you know, the part that shouldn't be, you know, understated is that Cash is the guy who gave Charlie a chance. Mm-hmm. You know, remember, under the previous genius manager of the Tampa Bay Rays, Charlie was in Durham, right? He's in AAA.
That's right.
He didn't get summoned to the big league coaching staff.
Yeah.
It was not until Kevin Cash took over. So from that, you might surmise that there's a different relationship between Charlie and the previous genius manager of the Tampa Bay Rays.
Interesting.
But he loves Kevin Cash, you know, and there's a lot, like, I think they chirp back and forth during ball games a whole lot. Same with Rocco Baldelli with the Twins, right? Because he was on that staff. Those guys are all really close.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't like, you know, this isn't like having Buck Showalter in the other dugout, just, you know, for a point of reference, like, or Tony La Russa or somebody who you might have a pretty solid hate on for. They're pals.
Yeah.
So, you know, for it to turn into something bigger, it would seem to be unlikely given the personalities involved. Okay. And also Kiermaier and Charlie Montoya are really close.
Yeah.
Really, really close. Kiermaier is like a, you know, big brother to Charlie's kids.
Really?
So, yeah. So there's a lot of really strong relationships there among that group of guys.
So reading between the lines, you're saying that Charlie Montoya was not emphatic in his praise of Joe Maddon for bringing in the farm animals or whatever he used to do.
He wasn't there. He was in the minors, working his tail off for minor league salary, waiting to, you know, thinking, hang on a second, how come I'm not on your staff? That's what he was doing. So he wasn't even there for dress up day.
Yeah.
He wasn't there for any of that stuff. So, so he owes Kevin Cash. He owes him. Yeah. Right? Like in a good way. Like Kevin Cash recognized Charlie for, you know, being what he is, which is a, you know, really good baseball man, a really good person.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's an interesting dynamic among that group of, I say kind of the next generation of Rays coaching and management. So yeah, it was interesting. It was a fun story for a day.
Yeah.
It probably doesn't change much. It's funny though. I was thinking about the afterwards, you know, we had Tabby on yesterday. And I don't know if you picked one of the interesting things he said, because he was talking about tipping pitches,
right,
was about not just, you know, picking up a guy tipping pitches, but how he said that a team would call another team.
Yeah.
Like if the, you know, the Jays are going to play the Yankees or whatever, yeah, and you know, that you'd kind of phone up, you know, Aaron Boone and say, hey, I don't know if you guys picked this up, but,
yeah,
you know, yeah, you're facing him on Tuesday. What? Look what he does with his thumb.
Yeah.
That's interesting to me.
Yeah, very. Well, and if you would do it strategically, like if,
yes,
if it aided you in your pursuit of the postseason.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And maybe that's, you know, we don't think about that as often, but, you know, like, and again, I'm not sure, you know, there's anything the Jays could have given the Texas Rangers to help them out against the Yankees right now because they're god awful. But
yeah.
But would you, you know,
yeah,
get on the phone and say, hey, you know, Garrett Cole, you just, you know, watch where he points his toe before he throws a breaking ball. Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. Like, I love all these little, love the glimpses inside because, you know, we don't actually get that stuff very often.
No, and I love that aspect of sport. I have no problem with it. I think it's kind of cool. And I guess it's agua under the bridge.
Agua under the bridge. That is correct.
We've been told that. All right. Let's take a break and come back and talk to Shai Davidi as Writer's Block continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. A classic rock masterpiece. And if you're after a more classic rock, you'll find the perfect mix in the Classic Rock Essentials playlist on Apple Music. From the 60s and 70s all the way to the 90s, listen to the Classic Rock Essentials playlist on Apple Music, which I use. That's just a fact. All right, let's bring in Shai Davidi, our man from Sportsnet, sportsnet.ca. How's it going, Shai? Are you into Heart?
Am I into Heart?
Yeah.
No.
All right. Appreciate your honesty.
That was straight up. That actually didn't take that long.
Yeah. No, that's fine. You didn't have to overthink it. It wasn't an ad read for Heart. Fine.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I just didn't want to engage in a conversation that wasn't going to go anywhere. So.
Okay. All right. Message received. All right. The Blue Jays. You know what? That was a gutsy effort yesterday. By Alec Manoah. It was a necessary outing considering, you know, going to the bullpen in the second inning with a bullpen game fast approaching in the finale of this three-game series would have been untenable. What is your expectation today, Julian Merriweather getting the start? Is this just three outs and out?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to open. Ross Stripling is, we're expecting to do the bulk innings. The likelihood is that Thomas Hatch is going to be activated. I haven't heard definitive word, but that seemed to be the way the Jays were leaning yesterday. So that giving them an extra layer in the bullpen there. And then we'll see how the Jays get through this one. But, you know, this is it's a one start thing. That's at least the expectation. You know, right now the plan is for Ryu to start the opener against the Yankees next week in Toronto. That's just his first day eligible to come off the IL. And so this is just one stopgap, although it turns out to be a stopgap in a pretty important game.
What's the – and I know Ryu has been playing catch, and I've – again, my understanding with Ryu, Shai, is that, you know, he's not a guy that throws bullpens between starts. It's he does his own thing. But so I'm not sure how they might conclude in between now and the beginning of that Yankees series that, you know, that he still wasn't quite ready to go unless he told them. But do you have any idea, like, if there's an issue with Ryu like what plan B would be, you know, is that, do they shorten the rotation for that last week?
Well, they're going to shorten it, or at least adapt it, right? Because if they stayed on turn, then they would be Mats and Barrios following in that series. And, you know, I think what they're going to do is they're going to push Mats back a couple days, move up Barrios and Ray on regular rest. And that lines up Barrios for a potential 163 and Ray for the wild card as well. So that's kind of what they're going to do in the back end. But in terms of Ryu, you know, the my understanding is that, you know, he was going to throw one side, possibly two, during this time. They were going to look at making, you know, perhaps a little adjustment or a little tweak there. You know, the concern is not that, you know, the velocity or the power hasn't been there. It's more that he hasn't been able to command the off speed and secondary. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if he's not doing that, then, you know, that's going to, it's going to make his fastball play down, and it's already not a great fastball. So, you know, that's the area of focus for them. And, you know, I think if they, they'll see based on what happens in those sides and the work in between, whether or not, you know, they may potentially need to adapt, or they can just stay on course with Ryu for the Monday, or, excuse me, the Tuesday.
And, you know, as you describe it though, Shai, it's kind of hard to imagine what, like, again, unless he's sore, what they would have to see for them to not let him go, right? Like, because it's not, you know, you're not talking about a guy, it's not a velocity issue, obviously. That's not his game. You know, and judging command in a bullpen in a side session, I guess you could do it, but it that sounds to me like it's, you know, highly, highly likely that he'll take that turn.
I mean, yeah, I would think unless there's some sort of physical reason for it to not happen, that they're going to ride, he's going to ride through in that start. And look, I get sort of the discourse in terms of how concerned people are, and, you know, it's two or three starts, and, you know, four of eight in where he's had not great outings. But he's still a guy that this team trusts. And you can look at it and say, okay, well, he's thrown the third most innings of his career, coming off the pandemic shortened season. You know, it's understandable there may be a little bit of a sputter. And I think part of this IL stint is, you know, okay, there was a little bit of tightness in the neck, but, you know, it's also just, you know, a bit of a reset, a breather, catch up, get a bit stronger, and then come back strong. I think that is, at least is part of the Blue Jays thinking at this point. We'll see whether, you know, that plays out or not.
Now, Ross Stripling hasn't been his best since he returned from the IL. He's only had two appearances. The second one was much better than the first, clearly. But he's had moments this season where he's looked great. Like, does his performance today impact the decision-making at all?
No, I don't think so. It's, you know, you're not pulling Ryu out of the rotation for Ross Stripling at this point, and that's not a comment on Ross Stripling, but, you know, Hyunjin Ryu, if he's ready to go, I mean, he's your guy, right? You don't just pull the plug on him unless there's really good reason for it. And, you know, I think, you know, for a number of reasons, you know, the Blue Jays need to see whether, you know, the little bit of a break combined with possible adjustment, you know, if that plays to fruition, because that's going to impact their planning beyond that as well. But, you know, they need Ross Stripling to be this guy who can step in moments like this, you know, whether it's with Ryu or, you know, if something crops up with somebody else. You know, this is part of what Ross Stripling's role is on this team at this point. And, you know, certainly he pitched better the last time, you know, gave up the home run, I think, the first batter, and then he was pretty steady beyond that. And, you know, I think the Blue Jays will be looking for a lot more of that this time around.
Shai, obviously the four pillars in the bullpen have been, the circle of trust with those guys is absolute, right? Beyond that, though, we're gonna see Merriweather as the opener today. I'm just wondering if you've got a sense of how they feel right now about Merriweather, Pearson, and I guess Baruchy would be the other guy I would throw in there, because everybody else, you know, is kind of maybe extraneous to purposes. But, you know, those three guys could, you know, if given the quality of the arms we're talking about, could be significant in the last 2 weeks, could be significant if they get to the postseason.
Yeah, I mean, the focal point, I think, is more on the first two guys in Merriweather and Pearson. And I think the way the Blue Jays are looking at it is that if one of those two guys pops, they need one of those two guys to pop, because at that point they feel that they're really strong. And, you know, I think that, you know, Trevor Richards has been great, but that was a nervous eighth inning before, of course, an even more nervous ninth inning. But, you know, I think the Blue Jays would love to have 98 in the eighth inning, a right-handed 98 option in the eighth inning to put before Romano in the ninth. And, you know, that could be Pearson, that could be Merriweather. I think with both right now, it's sort of one step forward, one step back, and they're just trying to get them reps, because they understand that not both guys haven't pitched a lot. Obviously, they're in situations now where it's a lot of leverage and a lot of stakes because of how important each game is right now. And that combination, you know, like, how do you do that and allow a guy to sort of get his work in but still make sure you're winning games and position yourself to get stronger? That's sort of the challenge. And, you know, if one of the, they're really hoping that one of those guys can just emerge and find a little bit of consistency, find a rhythm. And if just one of them does, I mean, obviously ideal both, but if simply one of them does, then that's a massive swing for this bullpen. They'd feel really well positioned, not just for the stretch drive, but potentially for the postseason as well.
Talking to Shai Davidi, they're well positioned offensively all over the diamond, but third base is, I guess, depending on who's playing there, the weakest offensive position. But there's, and not that either Kevin Biggio or Santiago Espinal is all of a sudden going to change the complexion of this offense, but those are very interesting players for different reasons who have been rehabbing with the Bisons. Do you have any idea about the progression of both guys? I mean, Biggio's actually come up with a couple of consecutive very good offensive games for the Bisons. Do you have any idea if those guys are, like, very close to arriving at the major league level?
Yeah, I mean, I heard Espinal could be back with the team as soon as Minnesota. It could potentially give them the weekend and then bring him back for New York. But he's, as of the last time I looked into it, the closer of the two. And, you know, with Biggio, I think what the Blue Jays are really hoping for is that they can get him locked in at the plate. Because obviously it's been a pretty difficult season for him. A lot of stops and starts, a lot of inconsistencies at the plate, some in the field defensively as well. There are some physical reasons that are a part of that. But, you know, anything that the Blue Jays do at this point, like, you have to insert a guy and he has to be performing. And, you know, Jake Lamb is on this team and he's a left-handed option for them at third base. But, you know, even if the, you know, even if he like got super hot, it wouldn't really matter because he wouldn't be eligible for the postseason because he wasn't on the roster as of August 31st. So, you know, the Blue Jays are going to need some options if they make it to the postseason. You know, Espinal certainly sounds like he's going to be one, and the Blue Jays would be thrilled if Biggio made himself one of those options as well. But, you know, that has to, he's got to lock it in at Buffalo because, again, you know, you're putting guys into situations that are super important, and every at bat matters. And, you know, even though, you know, the Biggio talent may be better than, you know, a Brevik Valera or a Jake Lamb, you know, if he's still trying to find his timing and his rhythm and has had the season that he's had, you know, you might be better with guys who are comfortable and already performing at peak instead.
Well, I was going to say, also, Shai, how comfortable would they be with Kevin Biggio playing third base? Like the defensive part of his game.
You know, I think there was confidence. You know, he obviously hasn't played a ton right now. So how are you going to kind of throw him back into that? You know, that's part of what has to take place in Buffalo too. But, you know, he could be on this team and it's not just, you know, to play third base every day. It could just be to come in and provide an at bat to, you know, spell, you know, give them another left-handed option for center field on occasion if they wanted to go that route. So it's not just one spot where he could fit in. That's the obvious one. We know the need at third base, and we know the situation at third base, and that's the one that's most glaring. But, you know, defensively, they could also do something where, you know, you play him for, you know, 5 to 7 innings, and then Espinal comes in for defense after that and to close it out. So, you know, we've seen the Blue Jays get creative at a number of spots around the diamond. You know, they're doing that with Dyson a fair bit in the outfield, you know, getting Gurriel out. So, you know, that's certainly something that they could do as well if they thought the bat was going to justify it.
George Springer had a couple of good at-bats yesterday, and I guess he's coming along a little bit. The offensive numbers this month have not been great. He had a rather big hit in Baltimore. But Charlie, I think it was before game one of the series, talked about him being day-to-day to potentially be a defender again in center field. We've seen him run the bases rather well. Like, do you think that's maybe a today thing or, you know, rather soon thing before the end of the regular season?
I didn't get the sense that it would be something here or, you know, maybe in Minnesota potentially, but I don't think this is something that they're going to push, right? I mean, the key thing here is the bat, obviously, in getting that in the lineup and letting him get that straight. And you're right, you know, there were better at bats and you're starting to see him get a little bit more timing. Maybe he's starting to learn how he has to how he has to hit and how he what he can do on that knee, you know, just how much, you know, how much it can take, and adjusting his game accordingly. So, you know, that I think is obviously the priority for them. But if they can get him to the outfield, look, it would help because, you know, the guys who were getting the occasional DH day just to have a bit of a break, you know, that isn't happening for them. They have to run through, and you know, Charlie and the Blue Jays staff would really love, in an ideal world, to be able to spread those DH days around. But, you know, if this is the way you've got to set up, this is the way you've got to set up.
Do you have any better sense, I've been around the team, of what this injury actually, what it is? Like, he does, you know, running a straight line on the bases, or even running the bases not a straight line, he looks like himself. He's obviously wearing the brace. I know there's a sense that it won't get worse, but, you know, is this something, like, do you get the sense this is something that's going to have to be dealt with in the offseason? That there's something's going to have to happen for him to be, you know, ready to go in spring training?
I don't have sort of any further insight into that than sort of what we've seen. You know, the fact that he is playing, you know, if it was something that was more significant, my guess, and again, you know, certainly not a doctor, not even close, but if there was something that, you know, might have to be addressed in a meaningful way, I don't think he'd be playing right now, right? This is, you know, obviously this season's important, but, you know, it's a six-year investment in Springer, and a substantial one that you can't risk, you know, 5 years for one. So, you know, I don't think that there's anything sort of deeper or more significant that he's sort of playing through. But again, you know, maybe, you know, the extra wear and tear that, you know, playing at this point will eventually cause that. But, you know, everything the Blue Jays have said to this point, and, you know, logic would, you know, lead you to say that, yeah, you'd have to believe that in order to run him out there, is that he's not going to make anything worse by playing. And if he's not going to make anything worse and there's not sort of a real risk of anything there, then you would think that it's not something that's going to necessarily need a surgery or anything along those lines.
Good stuff. Shai, thanks, buddy.
No problem, guys. Have a good one. Enjoy it.
You too. Shai Davidi, Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca. Yeah, George Springer just turned 32 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the first injury he suffered this season. I guess you could qualify this one as more of the fluky variety than the soft tissue leg thing he had earlier on the season. And I'm sure fouling the ball off his knee when he was already suffering from knees, it didn't help. But yeah, this is a guy that missed some time before the 60-game season a year ago, and he only played 51 of the 60 games with the Astros. But before that, it was 122.
Yeah.
And he is now in his 30s. It's
yeah, although 32 is not, like, I'm not with modern athletes,
right?
You see guys 32, that doesn't feel like wear and tear time yet. That seems like prime of lifetime to me.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting. This is a guy that also basically split time between right field and center field in his last full season, in that 122 game season with the Astros. That I wonder, and this was always a part of the conversation in signing him to a 6-year deal, is that he's not a center fielder for all 6 years of those. But I think next year you still view him as a center fielder.
Well, because they don't have a center fielder other than they've got him and Randall Grichuk, right? They don't really have, and the guy, you know, the only other name that came up in terms of futures in center field was Austin Martin.
Yep.
Right, who's not a Blue Jay anymore. So I don't think Josh Palacios is your center fielder of the future. They don't. It's a bit of an, you know, like, they have an organizational surplus in catchers right now. Mm-hmm. I would say they have an organizational deficit in terms of outfielders. And the last few that have come along, you know, Jonathan Davis looks like a fourth or, you know, fourth outfielder on a, you know, maybe. And he's gone, obviously. Palacios, I think, same thing, right? Mm-hmm. Guy who's a fourth outfielder, maybe, you know, or maybe a 4A guy. So that hasn't. Yeah, we haven't seen they had a glut in a good way of infielders. They have a lot of catchers, but the outfield situation may be something. Even though they just signed Springer to that deal, we may be talking about that still in the next couple of years, I would say.
No, it's a good point. And maybe Kevin Biggio's future is in the outfield, but
I think the jury's completely out there.
Yeah,
you know, on a lot of, and just completely in terms of what he is.
Yeah. Whether he's a major leaguer or not.
Yeah.
All right. When we come back, NHL with a bunch of opening training camp media days and some interesting comments coming out of a couple of organizations, including the Toronto Maple Leafs. as far as vaccine status is concerned. Maybe we'll just touch on that before we talk to David Amber at the top of the clock. It is Writer's Block. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's really interesting how sports have kind of been, I don't know, test subject, the bellwether during the pandemic. Like, things have happened in sports, whether it's playing in bubbles or protocols, that have kind of given us an indication of where things should go, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. And I kind of think the same thing is happening right now with the vaccine status that we're seeing and some of the conversations that's coming out of the NHL. Elliot Friedman today, in his 32 thoughts now on sportsnet.ca, said there are players who did not want to get vaccinated, eventually did so because they didn't want to, because they want to play, didn't want to risk their salaries, and reminded their teams are depending on them. And I think this is in direct reference, well, maybe not direct, but one of the players that that is referring to is Duncan Keith. And Ken Holland today talking about Keith's, I guess, pending vaccine status. He's in the process of being vaccinated because, guess what? He wants to play hockey. It is going to be virtually impossible for a player in the NHL to play this season if they are unvaccinated. I would say probably more so even if you're in a Canadian market, because you're going to play more games across the border than you are in an American market. You're still going to cross the border if you're in an American market, but I guess in theory you could miss those games.
It's an open question whether you can get on a charter flight in Canada,
right?
Like, you know, whether you're, again, at the Canadian Football League's interpretation is that you cannot if you're unvaccinated. So in theory, you're playing home games, right, if you're unvaccinated. That's so, yeah, no one is, you know it's not it's not mandatory, but as you said, with other aspects of life, just kind of narrowing the options here, right?
Well, this is it because what is today the day? The 22nd. Today is the day. And I guess I got my vaccine receipt is just an email form on my phone. I think I maybe have to print it off into a hard copy before we get whatever app is happening next month, whatever. But that I wondered, and apparently this has already happened, that there was a big spike in first dose vaccines once this was announced, and now that it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The people are being strong-armed into getting the vaccine, and it's been, for my money, it's a good thing.
Yes.
And it's happening in sports. The sports were the first place that it's happening, because the NHL, I'm telling you, there's more than 2% of the NHL populace who, given their own devices, would prefer not to be vaccinated, but are doing it because you can't go to work if you're unvaccinated.
Yes. Yes. That's all true, and it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is good. By whatever means necessary, as someone once said,
mm-hmm.
If that's what it's going to take to get the, like, there's going to be, I'm not sure what the percentage is. There will be holdouts.
Well, Ken Holland said there's one player. He has one player. They're projecting one player on his roster that will not be vaccinated for the upcoming season. And I have no idea how that person is going to function, what the contract status will be when that player is ruled ineligible from travel. I guess he's just playing the home games, or like he's got to take a train or a bus. I don't know.
Well, and imagine within the context of the team environment of team sports,
mm-hmm.
having to stare at the other guys in that room.
Yeah.
And for them saying, this is making it more difficult for us to win or to be a team or any of those other, peer pressure can sometimes, it can be a negative.
Right.
Occasionally it's a positive.
No,
this would be a positive.
Yeah. I think quite often, my 6-year-old in grade one, peer pressure, not a good thing.
But yeah, that's probably right. Yes, it's exactly. When your peers say, "Hey, try this," that's often a bad. That's often a bad thing, right? But in this case, it's a good thing.
Yep, this is a good thing. Today is McHappy Day. This year, every purchase across the full McDonald's menu supports families with sick children and local children's charities. The impact of Ronald McDonald House Charities across our communities is far-reaching. Today, 1 in 4 Canadians has either stayed at RMHC or know someone who has. Don't forget, while you're at McDonald's, you can ask to round up your order, and the difference will be donated to RMHC in your community. When we come back, as mentioned, media day for a bunch of different franchises around the NHL as camps open up, including the Toronto Maple Leafs. They spoke today. We'll talk to David Amber, the NHL on Sportsnet, and Hockey Night in Canada next. As Writer's Block continues, Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. All right, final hour of Writer's Block before we hand it over to Baseball Central, before they hand it over to real-life afternoon baseball. Blue Jays and Tampa Bay Rays wrapping up a three-game series. Won't be long now before you see David Amber's face on Sportsnet as the National Hockey League season. Oh, it's fast approaching. And he'll be in New Digs in these brand-new studios, which I've yet to see, which are in the building that I'm currently in right now. How's it going, David?
It's going well, and I got my first look at the new digs. It's a construction zone, so I'm interested to see. I hope they're not the same guys who are renovating my house a few years back, or else we might not be in that studio till 2023.
I believe there is a deadline here. How is I'm most intrigued by hockey guys because they disappear in the summer, right? You have that and get their blood changed and stuff, and whatever you guys do. you're there every night and then you're not there for a couple of months. Before we get on to the very serious business of training camp press avails, how was your recharge summer, sir?
It was really good. And that's the best way to put it. Recharge summer. Cause it felt long last season only because we kind of went in that bubble in 2020 and then almost felt like right away we were back into another season and it was compressed, and I'm not complaining, trust me, but it was just, it felt like there was a lot of hockey in a short period of time. So it was good. I, you know, rented a place up north for a little bit, had a little bit of time to relax and enjoy myself with the family, which is really good, and get, as you said, recharged. So I'm ready to go, and the season can't start soon enough as far as the Leafs are concerned, that's for sure.
Yes, because then they don't have to talk about last season. Yes, that's...
that was my takeaway from the media availability today, is they just want to pen the next chapter, and it's been, you know, it's been somewhat of a tragedy slash comedy for, you know, fool me once, shame on them, fool me 54 times, you know, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's been what, 54 years. And I know Kyle Dubas has said, well, we're not carrying around the burden of 54 years, but they're certainly carrying around the burden of how everything shook down in against Montreal in that series. And I know they just want to pen the next chapter, I'm sure.
Yeah, they do. And a bunch of wins will at least tamp that down for a little bit. Yeah. Does this mean anything? Like the way they're reacting now, the way they're addressing the failures of last postseason, the Mitch Marner dragging through the mud and like analyzing every single word that he says and how culpable he makes himself for the 7-game series loss to the Montreal Canadiens. Does that impact the way you view this upcoming season?
I mean, I think, you know, we, and like the Leafs, I'm sure everyone wants to sort of turn the page and get to the next part of it, but we're not going to get past, you know, what happened in that series quickly. And I think as much as Mitch Marner and a lot of the guys want to sort of dismiss it, you know, the fan base, from what I can tell, and you guys, I'm sure, experienced it as well with your interaction with Leaf fans, it felt different to me than the losses in previous years. It even felt different than, you know, the disappointing shutout loss in Game 5 to Columbus, where they were expected to win that one as well. It just felt like the whole sort of hockey world, the weight of the hockey world was dropping right onto the Leafs and certainly onto their key players. You know, Mitch Marner's done everything, I think, to deflect from that and sort of say, hey, we're moving on. But really, I'm interested to see, guys, if they don't get off to a great start, you know, what's going to happen in October? What's going to happen in early November if this team struggles out of the gate? And they very well could. So, you know, it's not so much that they need hockey coaches as much as they might need psychologists, right?
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting to me is there's just so many interesting storylines. It's not about playing hockey. It's about, you know, overcoming, you know, a very difficult, you know, psychological situation. The psyche of this team, I think, has been fractured a little bit. And I'd like to see how they rebound from that.
Yeah, I think because it is different, right? Like the Columbus thing in the bubble, I guess I have no idea what that, you know, like that was in the middle of the strangest time and the strangest time of everything. But, you know, and I know they you know, played kind of in that hothouse Scotiabank North Division last year, and that was a bit unreal. But the difference between this and all of the other 54 years is, the winner of that division had a free ticket to the semifinals. They were up 3-1 on a team that they finished 28 points ahead of in the regular season. It's just there's no, like, you can talk about the Boston, blowing playoff series to the Bruins and stuff like that in recent past, but there's no comparable for that, David. But the flip side is if they get out of the gate slowly, or if, after Christmas, and they're going to be in deeper water this year in terms of the competition in division, what do you do? Right. Ben and I were talking about this earlier in the week. It's kind of like all these are all puzzle pieces, starting with, Brendan Shanahan, and then to Dubas, and then to Keefe, and then to the four guys. And then, you can't just pull one piece out and say, this is the problem, because this is all part of a master plan.
And the nastiest twist, maybe looking back and reflecting on last season, is now there's going to be this Amazon Prime doc, All or Nothing. The funniest title ever. and the reason I even bring that up is not to belittle, what happened to the Leafs, but it's more like the whole, position of All or Nothing. I mean, that's sort of where we're at now, right? We were expecting maybe some big, significant moves in this off season, knowing about the failure that just occurred, and that didn't really happen. I mean, it really didn't. I no one's going to sit there and say, "Ooh, Nick Ritchie or Andre Cascio or Michael Bunting is going to change things around." Big picture, is this Leaf team better right now than they were a year ago? You're not going to fire, better than the team that lost in May. Probably not, right? I mean, they're probably not a better team on paper. So, it's going to be very interesting to see. I imagine, they've made it pretty clear, at least it seems like they've publicly said, this is sort of a last go around, from the key nucleus of the team all the way up through the management levels. Something big will have to shake down. And, Brian Burke, he said this in real time when the Leafs signed those big contracts to the Big Four. He said, this hasn't been a blueprint that we've ever seen another team use and it work. And maybe it's going to come down to that. If we're not going to see, the type of success from the core four there that are making close to $40 million. And remember, the cap isn't moving. Poor Kyle Dubas and Leaf management, without COVID, the cap might be at $87.5 million right now. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference, right? So I'm imagining, if things get off to a slow start, there's going to be a lot of speculation about what's going to happen, and some shoes are going to drop for sure.
Thank you for bringing up the All or Nothing Amazon Prime doc, which I guess launches October 1st. And I don't know if you've seen any of it. Apparently, Sid Sixero is such a big personality in Canadian media, naturally, on Breakfast Television. Now, he has seen a couple of the episodes, was tweeting about his excitement level for it. Elliot Friedman, in his 32 Thoughts, referenced it. And apparently, the Nylander camp, did push to have some things removed from it. And I went into this whole thing very skeptical, because the last time we saw the HBO 24/7, it was like Dion Phaneuf shoes, right?
Yes. Yeah, and there wasn't there a toaster or something?
Randy Carlisle.
Yeah, and Phil Kessel with the toaster. All of a sudden, though, I mean, with everything that has happened here in recent days with the media tour and the trying to tamp down of all this offseason stuff, it's like, it feels like it's going to be re-energized here when people start seeing this. And if it's actually something revealing, I can't imagine a worst case scenario for the Leafs.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested. I'm no Sid Sixero. I'm not Elliot Friedman. I'm not getting these preview screenings of anything. I have talked to some of the players, though, a little bit about the experience. And, they felt, there's some value there, because you can maybe see some of the pressure and strain and what life's like as a professional athlete. And we do forget that there is a human element. And it's not to excuse anything that shook down at the end of the last season for the Leafs, but there is a human element to that. And maybe in some respects, there'll be some level of empathy that some fans might be able to feel for the Leafs, because this is weighing on them. They're professionals. They want to succeed like anyone else. But yeah, I'm really interested. And it's funny that you say Nylander's camp maybe wanted to have some things edited out. It begs the question, what kind of things would they want edited out, right? I think it's going to be fascinating. The title is just the most ironic and perfect title.
Yeah.
And maybe this is the season, you know, maybe this is the season where some of these answers will be delivered.
Where do you think, but it, you know, again, if you had to, they are essentially this, you know, with the goaltending change, Mrazek for Anderson, obviously, and a couple little tweaks here, but they are, you know, very much like that team we last saw blowing that series to Montreal. Again, no slight to the Habs. Obviously, you had a great spring. But like when you start putting them back in with Tampa and with Florida and with Boston, what are they this year?
Well, that's a really good question, Stephen. I mean, you know, have they upgraded their goaltending, Peter Mrazek for Variety Anderson? In my humble opinion, I wouldn't think they've upgraded that situation. If Jack Campbell can be the guy he was last year, then they'll feel very comfortable with their goaltending tandem. You know, that's yet to be determined. Can he stay injury free starting 55 games, right? Like, that's something he hasn't done in his career. You know, the Zach Hyman situation, that to me is a great loss. Who's going to retrieve those pucks? Who's going to do all those dirty blue-collar things he did? He could play penalty kill. He could play power play. He could play up and down the lineup. Incredible versatility. Is Nick Ritchie that guy? He hasn't been that guy really in his career so far, and I believe this is now his third team. So, you know, there are questions there. But above and beyond all of that, the biggest question, again, will come back down to their core four forwards, right? And what can they produce, right? When Marner and Matthews, you know, they, you know, basically were 33% of the offense during the regular season and then collectively had one goal, which was less than 5% of the offense in the postseason, you know, that's not going to cut it, right? So it's going to be – there are those questions. And that's what I'm interested in, guys, is – you know, what's going to happen with this team? Because, you know, they've added all these sort of complementary pieces. But again, it's really going to come down to the core and how far this team can go. And then, like every team has a situation like this, but then we're going to obviously, being in Toronto and the mecca of hockey and everything else, we're going to be talking ad nauseum about Morgan Rielly's pending free agency. And so there's that kind of situation that's going to be hanging over the team as well. So there's no shortage of storylines. And I think, you know, we started this out and I said, I think the Leafs can't wait till October 13th and the season starts, because at least then we'll have some fresh new storylines to dig into, because right now all the storylines are, there's just so many questions there right now surrounding this team.
Well, and yeah, one of the camp storylines will be whether Josh Hosang can actually catch on with this team. Seems like he's the story du jour today. As you know, naturally you're going to go through the different players that are not guarantees to make this team, and they did a pretty good job of rejuvenating Alex Galchenyuk, although it has not resulted in a guaranteed contract this year. I think he's with the Coyotes on a PTO. But Hosang is a guy with great pedigree, right? Former first-round pick, and we know how circuitous the route has been for him. Do you have any expectation level that this could actually work for him?
Well, one thing I'll say is Kyle Dubas deserves a lot of credit. He's been very good with these reclamation projects, right? The Tyler Ennis's of the world. You know, we saw Galchenyuk, and he had some moments with the Leafs that are helpful. I wouldn't classify Jason Spezza in that same category, but he's had great success having these players come in who have something to prove at entry-level dollars, which you need to almost have those bargain basement salaries when you have these other guys making $11 million. And he's had some success in his tenure as the Toronto general manager, getting these guys and sort of finding these diamonds in the rough, if you will. And maybe Josh Hosang back in his home city on a PTO, you have to wonder if this is sort of his last kick at the can, even though he's not an old guy. You know, it clearly didn't work out with the Islanders, and he brings all that baggage with him. Nikita Gusev, another guy on a PTO. So I don't think you go in with any expectations, but you're hoping, once again, you put them into the right environment to succeed, and they can excel. And they can excel, most importantly, from a Leafs standpoint, for, you know, the league minimum, essentially, at $750K or somewhere in that ballpark. So I think that's really important. We've seen that in the past. And, you know, I think that's a part of what the Leafs figured they'd be able to do. When you're signing these guys to the big deals, you know you have to have a bunch of complimentary guys making close to the league minimum, so it's important. I'd love nothing more than Josh Hosang to have success, because he showed back in junior this guy was, you know, labeled to be a star in this league, and it just hasn't happened. And I'd love to see him have that opportunity work out, and it'd be nice if it worked out here in Toronto in his hometown.
I guess the other thing you need from taking kind of the economic view of the other franchise, David, in theory, is you need some of your young guys right there. You need Rasmus Sandin to play, right? I don't know what Liljegren's ever going to be, a guy like that, but some of those guys, right, on entry level deals who had certainly been talked about as, you know, foundation pieces of the future.
You need that.
You do, don't you? Really, especially with the flat cap. 100%.
Yeah, 100%. And you see that with the successful teams that they have these guys who kind of come up and find themselves at the right time. And you can go through the league and go through all the teams that have had success in the last 10 years. And yes, they've star players on those teams, but they also have those great storylines of the younger guys that maybe weren't expected to blossom at the time they did. And for the Leafs, that is going to have to be a Rasmus Sandin, right? You know, Justin Hall had a great sort of season, enough to the Leafs want to make sure they protected him. They have their grizzled veterans in Muzzin and Riley and TJ Brody on the blue line, and now, you know, they be that complementary piece. And Sandin could be that guy, right? He's a guy who brings so much promise with his you know, puck skills. He could perhaps anchor the power play, and the power play is a massive question for the Leafs coming in, because remember, they had the top power play in the league 27 games in, and they finished off the season. You know, it was dreadful. They were 5 for their last 73 in the last 29 games of the regular season, and then 3 for 23 in the playoffs versus Montreal. Clearly, you know, your power play has to be one of your greatest weapons when you have the personnel that the Leafs do. So, yeah, Rasmus Sandin, he's a key guy, and we're really interested. Our first show is on Saturday. We have Leafs Montreal, the first game of the season, preseason game, first game period in the NHL this year. And I'm really interested to see what the line combinations, the defensive pairings, and what Sheldon Keefe's going to do. So, Sandin's one of those guys, and if he can, you know, mature into the player that the Leafs had anticipated when they drafted him, then that's a huge, huge thing for Toronto moving forward.
Just before we let you go, David, last year, obviously, we had a guaranteed Canadian team in the Final Four. This year, we don't. If you look at this at the Canadian seven, they're saying all the right things in Edmonton. Like, this is the year. But the Leafs, you know, potentially, I guess. But do you think we'll see? You know, Winnipeg seems to be going in the wrong direction. I can't see any of the other teams. You know, Montreal's had that great run, but boy, there's so much change there and so much to deal with. Do you think there's gonna be a Canadian team in the Final Four this year?
Oh boy, I mean, you know, we're so much talk about gambling now, you know, Steve and Ben, I wouldn't put money down on a Canadian team being in the final this year. I mean, if you're going to go through sort of what the best teams in the league are, at least at this point, and which teams are viewed as the top teams, you're probably not going to have one of the Canadian teams there. But Toronto certainly still has the personnel if everything falls into place. And a team, you know, that I wouldn't sleep on are the Vancouver Canucks. I like what they've done this offseason. I know they have two huge signings to get figured out in Quinn Hughes and along in Pettersson. But I do like, adding OEL on the blue line, adding Connor Garland. I do like some of the things they've done. I do like the nucleus of that team. And like the Leafs, there's just a lot of great parts, and it's a matter of it coming together. I wouldn't sleep on the Canucks, but again, that would be something that's unforeseen if they made it to the Stanley Cup final. And for Toronto, you know, I think all bets are off after what happened last year. The path for them, you know, is so incredibly tough too. Tampa, yes, they lost their third line, but Tampa's still there. Florida's moving in the right direction. You can't sleep on the Bruins ever. And I even like, you know, the steps Ottawa's moving in the right direction as well. So it's going to be very, very difficult, path for the Leafs to get to the final. But never say never.
No. It's been a long time. But never say never. It starts, as you mentioned, on Saturday, Sportsnet 1, 7 o'clock. Leafs hosting the Montreal Canadiens, a preview of the opening day regular season matchup. Hey, David, thanks for doing this. Hope you enjoyed your off season, because right back into the meat grinder this weekend.
Yes, sir. Yeah, thanks for having me, guys, and look forward to it. Look forward to the Jays game this afternoon as well.
Yeah, us too. See David. It's David Amber. The NHL on Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. When we come back, David Sampson, former MLB executive, and host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson podcast. He joins us next as Writer's Block continues. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Day baseball fast approaching. Blue Jays trying to take the final series of the season against the Tampa Bay Rays and finish the season series within one of the Rays at 9-10. Bullpen game, Julian Merriweather against Luis Patino for the Rays. Before we get there, let's talk to David Sampson, former MLB executive and host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson, who is on the line right now. How's it going, David?
Good. How you doing?
We're doing well. Maybe we'll start with the story that kind of broke yesterday. Our own Arash Madani did a good job of following it up, but the cheat sheet, the scouting report thing that was in Alejandro Kirk's back pocket that fell out at home plate, and it was picked up by Kevin Kiermaier, and he wouldn't give it back and said it was September. I mean, just flatly, is that within the bounds of normally accepted subterfuge in the game?
No, not at all. I actually talked about it on today's Nothing Personal, and I'd love to go into some detail with you and your audience because it's outrageous. The Tampa Bay Rays are better than that. They're a great organization with really smart people, and they could not have handled this any worse. And you call it a cheat sheet. That's not really what it is. No one's cheating. It's not hitting garbage cans. It's what every team uses in order to have the best possible information on the other team, and you can't possibly remember it all. So it's the same thing as your quarterback having on his sleeve the list of plays and formations, which he just can't possibly be asked to remember. And once Kiermaier looked and saw it wasn't his, what you do is you give it back, and then you walk back to the dugout. And him claiming that he didn't look at it or didn't know what it was, he's absolutely full of it. He knew exactly what it was because his team has the same thing for the Blue Jays.
It's interesting because what is modern baseball etiquette, right? This isn't something we would have to worry about 20 years ago. But I guess one of the things that kind of surprises me here, Dave, we were talking about earlier in the show is that, Charlie Montoyo, manager of the Jays, this is he and Kevin Cash are pals. He was in that organization. Kiermaier is a guy that, this isn't baseball proxy war here where, the two dugouts hate each other. These guys are all, very close. And I thought it was an odd, I did think it was kind of an odd line to draw from the Tampa point of view. Like why would you say, no, we're not giving it to you? There's no point of principle, and I'm not. I you're right. There potentially isn't some advantage there, I guess, in having that information in your back pocket. But really, it seems like an odd stand to take from organizationally from a group who know the other manager, are pals with the other manager, and are not. This is not a life and death battle between these two teams right now.
Well, let's be clear. It's definitely not life or death in any way. And the reality is that Tampa's got the division sewn up, and the Blue Jays, as you know, are trying to get the wild card. But if they're so close, Montoya and Kevin Cash, then why exactly wouldn't Kevin have directed Paul Hoover, who happens to be a great guy, had him with the Marlins or Expos, who can remember? I think Marlins. Why wouldn't they have just walked back the next batter and walked out and given it right back and say, hey, you dropped this? Mm. And I don't understand why they doubled down and said, hey, we don't know exactly what it is. We looked quickly, but no, we're not going to give it back once we have it. That just makes no sense. When you find something that's not yours and belongs to someone else, that is an absolute moral violation not to give it back. It's like finding someone's wallet on the street and returning just the license and keeping the cash, or throwing out the license and keeping the cash. It just makes no sense to me.
Interesting. So how do you think this actually tangibly affects baseball? I imagine it must, right? Even if it's just to a small degree, the Rays batters now know the scouting report against them. Like how does this actually manifest itself on the field?
So great question. It really doesn't, because the funny part about all this that no one's talking about is that Tampa has the exact information on its own batters that the Blue Jays have on the Tampa batters. That's the interesting part about the analytics departments of these teams and all the information that we're all looking at. When you talk about what makes a big difference, when only one or two teams are using an amount of information, like in the beginning with defensive shifting, that had a pretty big impact on the outcome of games. But when all teams are using the same information to shift the same way in the same circumstances, all of a sudden that incremental advantage goes away because you're just doing what everybody else is doing. So I don't believe that the Blue Jays on that piece of paper have the nuclear codes or the formula for new Coke. I think they just had an approach and a recognition of what to do on a 2-1 count to Kiermaier with a runner on second base and a lead of 3 runs or fewer. That type of sort of micro information, but it's nothing the Rays didn't have, which makes it all the more strange that they wouldn't have just given the piece of paper
back.
Yeah,
that's, you know, makes perfect, like, it's not like it's, I guess to a degree it's proprietary data, but everybody's got the same data now, right? Like, there's not going to be anything and they're going to go, holy smokes, they're going to do that to Kiermaier? Because they're all looking at the same numbers, right? Like, it's not, yeah, it's not a, I want to go in a slightly different direction while we got here, David. We've been watching games from the beautiful Trop with the, you know, the usual, the usual collection glorious of family and friends there. During the pandemic, there hasn't been a ton of the stadium talk in Tampa that I picked up on. It's gone a little bit quiet, and same with the idea of the shared team in Montreal, with the potential ownership group there. Obviously, the pandemic has probably put a lot of stuff on hold business wise. But do you have any sense, you know, as to whether anything is progressing, you know, either on the Tampa St. Pete front or on the Montreal front with that team?
Well, in order to get something done when you need a new ballpark, you have to get right to the edge of the cliff and sort of hang off with your fingernails as they're scraping and you're falling off. And then the politicians seem to pay attention because there's real risk of losing the team. And while the Trop lease lasts for another 4 or 5 years, I think it's through 2027.
Yeah, that's right. So yes, it is. Yeah, it's 27.
Right. So we're not really at that point where it's do or die for Tampa to decide what they're going to do. But in terms of the split solution, you know, we've talked about it, especially with the pandemic and with tax revenues and the base so down in all these cities where money, just tourist dollars are obviously down. Everybody's expectation of where the amount of public money could be available from to get ballparks built. I find it very hard to believe that both Montreal and Tampa can find a way to get a ballpark built with only 3 months of use for each one, especially because of what's been happening here with the pandemic. But the reason it's quiet is that Tampa knows if I'm president of the Rays and I'm trying to get a ballpark, I'm not going after it right this very second because Tampa's got bigger fish to fry.
Talking to David Sampson. So Blue Jays beating the Rays, it kind of has a twofold purpose. One, obviously, you want to win every game going down the stretch of the season, try to get yourself into the postseason. But I find it interesting the idea that the Rays could be playing for something in those final three games of the season against a team the Blue Jays are expected to be battling with for that wild card spot. At that point, the New York Yankees in a big three-game series between the Blue Jays and the Yankees before that. But when initially you looked at that, those final three games for the Rays, and you thought, well, okay, that's a pretty tough way for the Yankees to finish, but hey, maybe the Rays will be home and cooled out. If they're not, if they're battling for home field advantage throughout the postseason or subsequent, like the other side of the coin, the winner of the American League as far as the team with the best record is going to face that wild card team, which could be the Blue Jays, which might be the team that you'd least want to face in the postseason. How do you view the Rays strategy and how those final three games could play out for them as they battle with the Astros for the best record in the American League?
So the general rule is this: when you are playing for home field advantage in any round and Tampa would be playing for the best record in the American League, you're playing to win. So if Tampa needs to win, they're going to try to win those last three games. The interesting question I've been thinking about is that if Tampa has it wrapped up, either way, let's say they're behind the Astros or they've clinched to be ahead of the Astros and they will have home field in the LCS, in a way they can control one of the teams in the wild card game. So if they want the Yankees in that game against the Blue Jays or Red Sox, they can roll over for three games, let the Yankees sweep, and that, my guess is, would be enough given how tight the race is to propel the Yankees into one of the wild cards. If, of course, they have the home field sewn up, but they prefer the Yankees to sit home in October, then they can go ahead and play their starters full games, do the rotation the way they would normally do, and play that straight up. So first they have to wait to see whether or not they need to win, and then they need to decide whether they want to win.
That's a really, that is, I like that. I like that, the idea of that level of intrigue. It seems to me, though, that like getting your rotation set up for the postseason whatever the circumstance, that's got to be, that is priority one for them, isn't it? They're in the postseason. They know that. And, you know, there might, like, I might rather play the White Sox than play the wild card winner. But rather than trying to kind of get too manipulative, isn't it more about just making sure your rotation's set up and everybody's healthy for game one?
Well, if you were the president of the Minnesota Twins and you had a choice that if you lost three games, you may not have to play the Yankees in the postseason, would you lose those three games?
Hmm. Well, that's interesting.
Minnesota Twins have gone a decade, right? Or
yeah.
Three straight years, whatever the number of years, yeah. They just can't beat them. And I don't have at the top of my head what the Rays have done against Yankees or Red Sox or Jays. But I promise you, their analytics department is looking very carefully at the rotation. They're looking at the opponents and trying to decide what's best for them on the assumption they secure home field first.
I guess the question would be, then, how to what length you would go to actually, you know,
right.
to Black Sox those three games? Like, what? how far would you actually go?
Well, if I'm the president of an organization that's never won a World Series and came one Blake Snell away from getting to a Game 7 last year, I'm going to say I'm going to go Sly Fox and let's go all the way.
That's interesting. They have a very similar record against all three of the potential playoff teams in the American League. They're 11-8 against the Red Sox. They're 9-7 against the Yankees, of course, with those three games to go. And headed into today's game, they're 10-8 against the Blue Jays. But, yeah, I guess it's eye of the beholder stuff. And I don't know if you put any stock into which team is hot. It seemed like the Blue Jays would be a good team to avoid. Well, we were just talking yesterday about tipping pitches and information shared between organizations, kind of going back to the information that the Rays may or may not have used in acquiring that sheet from Alejandro Kirk's back pocket. How often does that happen that organizations maybe, you know, with the same thing in mind that, you know, you're chasing a team that is playing some other team, that you would share information with the team that you want to win that you might have that could help you in a postseason race? How much information sharing happens in Major League Baseball between teams?
It happens actually at the lower levels. It happens with scouts. It happens with coaches. It rarely, if ever, happens with presidents and general managers. But what you do is you send information downstream because you know there's all sorts of – it's like Linda Richmond's coffee talk before a game and during games between scouts and people who work for organizations and the personnel department. So whenever we wanted to get a message to another team, we wouldn't do it by calling the owner or the president or the GM. We would have one of our personnel or assistant GMs have a conversation. So if we knew that there was something like pitch tipping, as an example, and we very much needed a team to lose, we would be more than happy to call the team they're playing and say, here, this is what we've seen, so act accordingly.
That is fascinating. See, yeah. I'm enjoying this stuff because that's kind of stuff normally, if from the outside and somebody had suggested that to me, I said, nah, they don't do that. That's yeah. Why, that's no. But you're now the second person in baseball in 24 hours that's told us that, of course, they do that.
So you'd be surprised what we do. We're just normal people running a business trying to win, right? And our wins and losses are there for everyone to see at 10:30 every night. And so we're going to do anything we have to do. It's why I didn't lose my mind when the Astros were hitting garbage cans, because I was just annoyed. I didn't think of it first as a way to get information to my hitters, right? It wasn't a matter of jealousy. It was a matter of anger that I couldn't do it and win a World Series. So I think the competitive nature of front offices should not be underestimated, but the personal relationships that exist with executives who go from place to place, people with the the Rays would be more than happy to speak to the Red Sox and Chaim Bloom, who is still going to be loyal to the Rays, even though he's running the Red Sox. He still has friends who work for the Rays, and there is communication that takes place.
David, always great. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, my pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. David Sampson, former MLB executive, host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson, making me feel like a bad person because I advocated for the keeping of the sheet. And listen, for the record, I would give the wallet back with all of its contents intact, okay?
Yes, you would.
I would.
Walk it to the person's house. But it's great, though, that he thought that was a, you know, that a violation of etiquette anymore.
I know, banging trash. I did notice that. I wasn't going to say it to him while he was still on the line, but
That's a bigger kind of conversation about ethics and morals, but it's interesting. But I love the idea that stuff actually goes on.
Yeah.
you know, buddy phoned you up and said, just so you know, the guy's coming to town now. You know, watch.
Yeah.
He might help you out. I think that is, both Tabby and David Sampson have now said that. So I will take that as gospel now.
Yeah. The other thing that is now, I mean, I brought it up, so it was already on my mind, but now is even more so in my mind, is those final three games for the Rays, and the Rays being kingmakers here in the American League. I'm of the belief, and clearly, yes, they're, whether they've clinched and home field advantage is important, having a game seven in the Trop, I guess, that'd be a big deal. Maybe people would show up for that game seven of the American League Championship Series. That's important. So if they're playing for that, it's irrelevant. But if something's been clinched one way or the other, the idea that you can manipulate your opponent, I'm of the belief that you do any of that stuff, you mess with the sports gods.
Well, number one, you mess with the sports gods. Number two, the guys you put on the field are going to, whoever they are going to try to win.
Right, this is...
And number three, if the Rays call some guy up from the minors to start one of those games, he'll be, like, amazing, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah, they don't... There's like, not enough garbage players in the organization.
They're going to try, like, who's a real stiff in our minor league organization that we could throw out there? You know, and the guy will be Shane Boz, right, or whatever. So, yeah, I think losing on purpose is harder than it seems, especially in baseball. I think it is kind of – because weird stuff happens.
No, I know. In baseball and blowouts, yeah, the idea of ending games quickly. You're always playing for the back of your baseball card up until the last game of the season.
The only time I absolutely knew it happened, it was I was following the Jays in a pennant race, and they were on the West Coast. I think they were eliminated. So I remember somebody made a catch at Fenway. We saw it on the screen.
Yeah.
And a guy ran behind. You couldn't see him actually make the catch. He was out of the – and then he came out, and the camera caught him, and he had the ball. And everybody realized in that moment the Jays are out. I think it was Hanky. Next pitch, it was a tie game, just serves up the fattest batting practice fastball I've ever seen. And whoever it was hit it out 100 miles. It was just like – with this, let's go have dinner.
Yeah, I get that. Oh, and yeah, it's a lesser degree, but I'll always believe that Troy Tulowitzki's spring training home run against Marcus Stroman at Dunedin.
Guaranteed. Given the two personalities involved?
Yes.
Now that we can talk about betting openly, yeah. I would bet on that.
Yeah, yeah. It was right into the tree. Wow, what a bomb that was.
Yeah, he's back.
He's going to haunt this team.
Yep.
I think I claimed that if he was back, I would eat my shirt.
And your shirt? You still have your shirt on?
Yeah. No, it's all good. All right. We'll get you set for Baseball Central, Blue Jays and Rays in a second. As Writer's Block continues, Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Well, the pandemic ends for no one until it ends for everyone. UNICEF is leading the procurement and delivery of 2 billion COVID-19 vaccines to countries around the world. An effort of this scale has never been done before. By donating to UNICEF Canada by September 30th, Canadians have the opportunity to make a difference and support the vaccination of millions of people in lower-income countries. Every dollar donated by September 30th will be matched by the Canadian government. Donate today at unicef.ca or text vaccines to 45678 to donate $10. Obviously, a very worthwhile cause. A little bit of Blue Jays news before the game today, the afternoon affair between the Jays and Rays to wrap up the series. Julian Merriweather against Luis Patino. Breivik Valera is on the COVID IL as part of contact tracing, and this is from Shai Davidi, after a family member contracted the virus. Blue Jays say he's fully vaccinated, has tested negative thus far. No counter move yet, but since then we've understood that Kevin Smith is en route to Tampa, and if he arrives by game time, he will be activated.
And you can come off the COVID IL quite quickly, right?
There's no minimum.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, and whatever the... I guess if he's just raising his hands that I've had close contact, I guess it would be up to him. Like, if he continues to test negatively, and I imagine he's going to have multiple tests now.
Yeah, I'm sure we could go figure out what the protocol is, but this isn't like he's gone for 10 days or anything. He could be he could be right back tomorrow.
Yep, but not in the lineup today. It is Jake Lamb playing third base, but again, he will not be available for the postseason. The Blue Jays get there. Gerard Dyson in center field batting ninth. We haven't seen him start many games. We've seen him as a defensive replacement, and it's Patino's right-handed pitcher. So I guess another lefty bat, but not much of a lefty bat.
Who's got the day off then, outfield-wise?
I guess it's Corey Dickerson. Not in the lineup. And, yes, of course, no Randall Grichuk either.
And Springer back in the DH spot as, yeah, you would expect, again, on turf, even if it's a day-to-day situation for him defensively, you're probably not going to activate him to play that position on whatever they're using, the painted concrete in Tampa.
Yeah. Well, you know, if they get any offense out of Dyson, it is a bonus at this stage in his career. You know, he'll run it. He can still run stuff down in the outfield. He actually moves pretty well in the outfield still.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and a fine addition, like a guy who has got at least a little bit of speed. And, you know, although apparently, according to the numbers, Teoscar Hernandez is a faster base runner than he is. But, yeah, somebody who can pinch run on occasion. I don't know. One of your catchers gets on base. Although, I mean, they pinch ran Danny Jansen for Alejandro Kirk. So, yeah, the bar is low for him.
The bar is low for him, yes. Anyway, it's not, probably not. You know, a roster move that I think probably whether Ross Stripling can get guys out today will have a more direct outcome in this game.
Yeah. Let's talk about Kirk briefly because you know what? Why not? I was going through the numbers because I was he's going through it right now, a bit of a slump. There's just no two ways about it. It has not gone necessarily well in a very small sample. Like I think that he's an 0-for-15 slump, but I think there's only two starts in there. There's a couple of pinch hit appearances. And all of those offers, save for one, he has one strikeout in there. That's all been balls in play.
Yeah.
And of those 15, I think I counted 10 of them had an exit velocity of 90. Because, and yes, do I defend the people I want to defend in the middle of 0-for-15 slumps? Of course I do. But I would say that anyone who's claiming that Alejandro Kirk is finally pumpkinning, I don't think that's necessarily
happening. He still barrels a lot of balls up for sure. I do think it's legit though that, you know, again, if you think of how little professional baseball he's played, you know, never mind how little Major League Baseball he's played, I would think there's more of a book being assembled on him, you know, in terms of how do you handle this guy? Because
right.
I think when he first showed up, I think everybody did what everybody's done in his entire life, looked at him and said, who is this,
right,
you know, oddly shaped baseball player? and then they went, holy smokes, right? He's got a great level swing and he barrels everything up and it's hard to throw a fastball by him. But I think we're probably in one of those little plateaus of adjustment that every hitter goes through, every ball player goes through. That wouldn't shock me. Because he, you know, they have handled him better. Like they have, you know, maybe he's just not as much of a surprise as he was, but that's going to be the challenge for him now.
Yes, you got to throw him strikes. People know that now.
Yeah.
That he's not somebody who generally will chase outside of the zone, and it's part of the reason why I've really enjoyed his offensive skill set since he's arrived at the major league level. You're right. And there's an adjustment, and there's usually an adjustment to the adjustment. We'll see if he's able to make it. Whatever adjustment Lourdes Gurriel Jr. has had to make since the awful start to his season, he's made it in space. Like, September is ridiculous. And I understand, like, there's ups and downs in everybody's season, right? And 1 month does not a great baseball player make. But this is what he's doing right now. And really, okay, he hasn't been hitting to this level since June 1st, but he's been pretty damn good.
Yes.
Since June 1st. And then I was having this conversation with Dan Shulman. I don't know if it was a show you were on as well, about, because he's the kingmaker, because he called the Teoscar Hernandez. Like, he had seen enough of Teoscar to understand,
yes,
that he was
called it. It's like calling an election, right?
Yeah.
Yes, we have declared. The decision desk has declared that Teoscar Hernandez is a big leaguer.
And he was right, because
he
right. is.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a great walk profile, but whatever. He's a 300 hitter,
yes,
with a 30 home run power.
And that started, what, in the summer of 2019, correct?
Yep.
Was kind of the moment when he figured it out. And then you thought, well, is this temporary, then the shortened season, and then now.
Yep. Yeah. So this isn't enough to say definitively that Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is this. But, again, outside of the first 2 months of this season, basically throughout his major league career, he's been a more consistent hitter than Teoscar Hernandez was early in his career.
Yes.
And I know this is a guy that we keep throwing into trade conversations in the offseason. Well, part of the reason is he's a pretty good contract.
Great contract. For the team, not for him necessarily.
No, not necessarily for him, but it kind of forced his way to the major leagues. Because if you recall, like, his minor league numbers didn't jump off the page.
No.
But he was paid, he was on a major league deal.
Yeah, and I think they may have had, again, I think there may have been kind of an agreement there about when he would join the major league club as part of that deal he signed.
And worked out for everybody.
It did.
But I wonder, like, I don't think anything's going to change for me in the final 2 weeks of the season, but this is eye-opening stuff. Like, it's not just the numbers. It's like the way he's approaching these plate appearances are remarkable.
If this is who he is, you know, then, you know, again, start adding up the pieces here. If this is who he is,
yeah.
He still takes weird routes to the ball in the outfield.
Yeah, yeah.
He's still a bit of an adventure. He's got a great arm. He runs in front of center fielders every once in a while. But
if there was a defensive position with less leverage than left field, he'd be playing it. But
yes,
that's it.
Yes, he would. But no, this on a team that's already an embarrassment of riches offensively, boy. Yeah. He's been tremendous.
Well, and it's not out of nowhere because they signed him to that major league deal, and obviously the bloodlines are good. But I remember talking to Jim Bowden, former major league general manager, about who he was most excited about on this Blue Jays team. And he was the first name he mentioned. Now, granted, it was like he's boring to talk about Vlad or Bo, right? Mm-hmm. And those guys had more established themselves. But he viewed him as a potential 30, 40 home run guy. And it just didn't happen right out of the gate. So he's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And now he's hitting seventh for this team. But he's OPSing like 1,200 this month.
Yeah, and if you can park him in the 6 or 7 slot, you know, talk about lengthening the lineup.
Yeah.
It's not bad. No, I agree with everything you said. I may not be quite at the Dan Schulman declare point yet.
No, and he wasn't. I don't want to put words in Dan's mouth, who is, I guess, here right now, too, so he could defend himself if he wanted to. But, yeah, he said he needed to see it a little bit more. So I think that's probably where most people are on him. Hey, today is McHappy Day. This year, every purchase across the full McDonald's menu supports families with sick children and local children's charities. The impact of Ronald McDonald House charities across our communities is far-reaching. Today, 1 in 4 Canadians has either stayed at RMHC or know someone who has. Don't forget, while you're at McDonald's, you can ask to round up your order, and the difference will be donated to RMHC in your community. Blue Jays and Tampa Bay Rays getting set to wrap up not just this series, the season series. It's the rubber match this afternoon. A bullpen game to some degree. Julian Merriweather going to be the opener. Ross Stripling going to be the bulk man against Luis Patino. A win would not only give the Blue Jays victory in this series, it would cut the season series deficit to 9-10 against the best team right now in the American League. Baseball Central will take you up until first pitch. Blair and Barker next. We'll be back tomorrow. Bye-bye.